Donna dozed off, and when she woke up again, all the shadows had blended with one another, and the last of the light in the camber driveway was the color of ashes. It was dusk. Somehow it had gotten around to dusk again, and they were unbelievably still here. The sun sat on the horizon, round and scarlet-orange. It looked to her like a basketball that had been dipped in blood. She moved her tongue around in her mouth. Saliva that had clotted into a thick gum broke apart reluctantly and became more or less ordinary spit again. Her throat felt like flannel. She thought how wonderful it would be to lie under the garden faucet at home, turn the spigot on full, open her mouth, and just let the icy water cascade in. The image was powerful enough to make her shiver and break out in a skitter of goose flesh, powerful enough to make her head ache. Was the dog still in front of the car? She looked, but of course there was no real way of telling. All she could see for sure was that it wasn't in front of the barn. She tapped the horn, but it only produced a rusty hoot, and nothing changed. He could be anywhere. She ran her finger along the silver crack in her window and wondered what would happen if the dog hit the glass a few more times. Could it break through? She wouldn't have believed so 24 hours before, but now she wasn't so sure. She looked at the door leading to Camber's porch again. It seemed farther away than it had before. That made her think of a concept they had discussed in a college psychology course. Ide Fix, the instructor, a prissy little man with a toothbrush mustache, had called it. If you get on a down escalator that isn't moving, you'll suddenly find it very hard to walk. That had amused her so much that she had eventually found a down escalator in Bloomingdale's that was marked out of order and had walked down it. She had found, to her further amusement, that the prissy little associate professor was right. Your legs just didn't want to move. That had led her to try and imagine what would happen to your head if the stairs in your house suddenly started to move as you were walking down them. The very idea had made her laugh out loud. But it wasn't so funny now. As a matter of fact, it wasn't funny at all. That porch door definitely looked farther away. The dog's psyching me out. She tried to reject the thought as soon as it occurred to her, and then stopped trying. Things had become too desperate now to indulge in the luxury of lying to herself. Knowingly or unknowingly, Cujo was psyching her out, using perhaps her own E-Day fix of how the world was supposed to be. But things had changed. The smooth escalator ride was over. She could not just continue to stand on the still steps with her son and wait for somebody to start the motor again. The fact was, she and Tad were under siege by dog. Tad was sleeping. If the dog was in the barn, she could make it now. But if it's still in front of the car, or under it. She remembered something her father used to say sometimes when he was watching the pro football games on TV. Her dad almost always got tanked for these occasions, and usually ate a large plate of cold beans left over from Saturday night supper. As a result, the TV room was uninhabitable for normal Earth life by the fourth quarter. Even the dog would slink out, an uneasy deserter's grin on his face. This saying of her father's was reserved for particularly fine tackles and intercepted passes. "He laid back in the tall bushes on that one," her father would cry. It drove her mother crazy. But by the time Donna was a teenager, almost everything about her father drove her mother crazy. She now had a vision of Cujo in front of the Pinto, not sleeping at all, but crouched on the gravel with his back legs coiled under him, his bloodshot eyes fixed intently on the spot where she would first appear if she left the car on the driver's side. He was waiting for her. hoping she would be foolish enough to get out. He was laying back in the tall bushes for her. She rubbed both hands over her face in a quick and nervous washing gesture. Overhead, Venus now peeked out of the darkening blue. The sun had made its exit, leaving a still but somehow crazed yellow light over the fields. Somewhere a bird sang, stopped, then sang again. It came to her that she was nowhere near as anxious to leave the car and run for the door as she had been that afternoon. Part of it was having dozed off and then wakened, not knowing exactly where the dog was. Part of it was the simple fact that the heat was drawing back, the tormenting heat, and what it was doing to Tad had been the biggest thing goading her to make a move. It was quite comfortable in the car now, and Tad's half-lidded, half-swooning state had become a real sleep. He was resting comfortably, at least for the time being. But she was afraid those things were secondary to the main reason she was still here. That little by little, some psychological point of readiness had been reached and passed. She remembered from her childhood diving lessons at Camp Topowingo that there came an instant that first time on the high board when you either had to try it or retreat ignominiously to let the girl behind you have her crack at it. There came a day during the learning to drive experience when you finally had to leave the empty country roads behind and try it in the city. There came a time, always there came a time, a time to dive, a time to drive, a time to try for the back door. Sooner or later, the dog would show itself. The situation was bad, granted, but not yet desperate. The right time came around in cycles. That was not anything she had been taught in a psychology class. It was something she knew instinctively. If you chickened down from the high board on Monday, there was no law that said you couldn't go right back again on Tuesday. You could. Reluctantly, her mind told her that was a deadly false bit of reasoning. She was not as strong tonight as she had been last night. She would be even weaker and more dehydrated tomorrow morning. And that was not the worst of it. She had been sitting almost all the time for how long? It didn't seem possible, but it was now some 28 hours. What if she was too stiff to do it? What if she got halfway to the porch only to be doubled up and then dropped flopping to the ground by Charlie horses in the big muscles of her thighs? In matters of life and death, her mind told her implacably, the right time only comes around once. Once, and then it's gone. Her breathing and heart rate had speeded up. Her body was aware she was going to make the try before her mind was. Then she was wrapping her shirt more firmly about her right hand. Her left hand was settling on the door handle, and she knew. There had been no conscious decision she was aware of. Suddenly, she was simply going. She was going now, while Tad slept deeply, and there was no danger he would bolt out after her. She pulled the door handle up, her hand sweat slick. She was holding her breath, listening for any change in the world. The bird sang again. That was all. If he's bashed the door too far out of shape, it won't even open, she thought. That would be a kind of bitter relief. She could sit back then, rethink her options, see if there was anything she had left out of her calculations, and get a little thirstier, a little weaker, a little slower. She brought pressure to bear against the door, slugging her left shoulder against it, gradually settling more and more of her weight upon it. Her right hand was sweating inside the cotton shirt. Her fist was so tightly clenched that the fingers ached. Dimly, she could feel the crescents of her nails biting into her palm. Over and over in her mind's eye, she saw herself punching through the glass beside the knob of the porch door, heard the tinkle of the shards striking the boards inside, saw herself reaching for the handle. But the car door wasn't opening. She shoved as hard as she could, straining, the cords in her neck standing out. But it wasn't opening. Then it did open, all of a sudden. It swung wide with a terrible clunking sound, almost spilling her out on all fours. She grabbed for the door handle, missed, and grabbed again. She held the handle, and suddenly a panicky certainty stole into her mind. It was as cold and numbing as a doctor's verdict of inoperable cancer. She had gotten the door open, but it wouldn't close again. The dog was going to leap in and kill them both. Tad would have perhaps one confused moment of waking, one last merciful instant in which to believe it was a dream, before Cujo's teeth ripped his throat open. Her breath rattled in and out, quick and quick. It felt like hot straw. It seemed that she could see each and every piece of gravel in the driveway, but it was hard to think. Her thoughts tumbled wildly. Scenes out of her past zipped through the foreground of her mind like a film of a parade which had been speeded up until the marching bands and horseback riders and baton twirlers seemed to be fleeing the scene of some weird crime. The garbage disposal regurgitating a nasty green mess all over the kitchen ceiling, backing up through the bar sink. Falling off the back porch when she was 5 and breaking her wrist. Looking down at herself during period 2 algebra one day when she was a high school freshman and seeing to her utter shame and horror that there were spots of blood on her light blue linen skirt. She had started her period. How was she ever going to get up from her seat when the bell rang without everybody seeing, without everyone knowing that Donna Rose was having her period? The first boy she had ever kissed with her mouth open, Dwight Sampson. Holding Tad in her arms, newborn, then the nurse taking him away. She wanted to tell the nurse not to do that. Give him back. I'm not done with him. Those were the words that had come to mind. But she was too weak to talk. And then the horrible, squelching, gutty sound of the afterbirth coming out of her. She remembered thinking, I'm puking up his life support systems. And then she had passed out. Her father crying at her wedding and then getting drunk at the reception. Faces, voices, rooms, scenes, books. The terror of this moment, thinking, I am going to die. With a tremendous effort, she got herself under some kind of control. She got the Pinto's door handle in both hands and gave it a tremendous yank. The door flew shut. There was that clunk again, as the hinge Cujo had knocked out of True protested. There was a hefty bang when the door slammed closed that made Tad jump and then mutter a bit in his sleep. Donna leaned back in her seat, shaking helplessly all over, and cried silently. Hot tears slipped out from under her lids and ran back on a slant toward her ears. She had never in her life been so afraid of anything, not even in her room at night when she was little, and it had seemed to her that there were spiders everywhere. She couldn't go now, she assured herself. It was unthinkable. She was totally done up. Her nerves were shot. Better to wait. Wait for a better chance. But she didn't dare let that E-Day become fix. There wasn't going to be a better chance than this one. Tad was out of it, and the dog was out of it, too. It had to be true. All logic declared it to be true. That first loud clunk, then another one when she pulled the door to, and the slam of the door actually shutting again. It would have brought him on the run if he had been in front of the car. He might be in the barn, but she believed he would have heard the noise in there as well. He had almost surely gone wandering off somewhere. There was never going to be a better chance than right now. And if she was too scared to do it for herself, she mustn't be too scared to do it for Tad. All suitably noble. But what finally persuaded her was a vision of letting herself into the Campers' darkened house, the reassuring feel of the telephone in her hand. She could hear herself talking to one of Sheriff Bannerman's deputies quite calmly and rationally, and then putting the phone down, then going into the kitchen for a cold glass of water. She opened the door again, prepared for the clunking sound this time, but still wincing when it came. She cursed the dog in her heart, hoping it was already lying someplace dead of a convulsion and fly-blown. She swung her legs out, wincing at the stiffness and the pain. She put her tennis shoes on the gravel, and little by little she stood up under the darkling sky. The birds sang somewhere nearby. It sang three notes and was still. Cujo heard the door open again, as instinct had told him it would. The first time it opened, he had almost come around from the front of the car where he had been lying in a semi-stupor. He had almost come around to get the woman who had caused this dreadful pain in his head and in his body. He had almost come around, but that instinct had commanded him to lie still instead. The woman was only trying to draw him out, the instinct counseled, and this had proved to be true. As the sickness had tightened down on him, sinking into his nervous system like a ravenous grass fire, all dove-gray smoke and low rose-colored flame, as it continued to go about its work of destroying his established patterns of thought and behavior, it had somehow deepened his cunning. He was sure to get the woman and the boy. They had caused his pain, both the agony in his body and the terrible hurt in his head, which had come from leaping against the car again and again. Twice today he had forgotten about the woman and the boy, leaving the barn by the dog bolt hole that Joe Camber had cut in the door of the back room where he kept his accounts. He had gone down to the marsh at the back of the Camber property, both times passing quite close to the overgrown entrance to the limestone cave where the bats roosted. There was water in the marsh, and he was horribly thirsty. But the actual sight of the water had driven him into a frenzy both times. He wanted to drink the water, kill the water, bathe in the water, piss and shit in the water, cover it over with dirt, savage it, make it bleed. Both times this terrible confusion of feelings had driven him away, whining and trembling. The woman and the boy had made all this happen, and he would leave them no more. No human who had ever lived would have found a dog more faithful or more set in his purpose. He would wait until he could get at them. If necessary, he would wait until the world ended. He would wait. He would stand a watch. It was the woman most of all. The way she looked at him, as if to say, "Yes, yes, I did it. I made you sick. I made you hurt. I devised this agony just for you, and it will be with you always now." Oh, kill her. Kill her. A sound came. It was a soft sound, but it did not escape Cujo. His ears were preternaturally attuned to all sounds now. The entire spectrum of the aural world was his. He heard the chimes of heaven and the hoarse screams which uprose from hell. In his madness, he heard the real and the unreal. It was the soft sound of small stones slipping and grinding against each other. Cujo screwed his hindquarters down against the ground and waited for her. Urine, warm and painful, ran out of him unheeded. He waited for the woman to show herself. When she did, he would kill her. In the downstairs wreckage of the Trenton house, the telephone began to ring. It burred 6 times, 8 times, 10. Then it was silent. Shortly after, the Trenton's copy of the Castle Rock Call thumped against the front door, and Billy Freeman pedaled on up the street on his Raleigh with his canvas sack over his shoulder, whistling. In Tad's room, the closet door stood open, and an unspeakable dry smell, lion-like and savage, hung in the air. In Boston, an operator asked Vic Trenton if he would like her to keep trying. "No, that's okay, operator," he said, and hung up. Roger had found the Red Sox playing Kansas City on Channel 38 and was sitting on the sofa in his skivvies with a room service sandwich and a glass of milk, watching the warm-ups. "Of all your habits," Vic said, "most of which range from the actively offensive to the mildly disgusting, I think that eating in your underpants is probably the worst." "Listen to this guy," Roger said mildly to the empty room at large. "He's 32 years old, and he still calls underwear shorts underpants." "What's wrong with that?"
"Nothing.
If you're still one of the owl tent at summer camp." "I'm going to cut your throat tonight, Rog," Vic said, smiling happily. "You'll wake up strangling in your own blood. You'll be sorry, but it will be too late." He picked up half of Roger's hot pastrami sandwich and wounded it grievously. "That's pretty fucking unsanitary," Roger said, brushing crumbs from his bare, hairy chest. "Donna wasn't home, huh?" "Uh-uh. She and Tad probably went down to the Tasty Freeze to catch a couple of burgers or something. I wish to God I was there instead of Boston." "Oh, just think," Roger said, grinning maliciously. "We'll be in the Apple tomorrow night, having cocktails under the clock at the Biltmore." "Fuck the Biltmore and fuck the clock," Vic said. "Anyone who spends a week away from Maine on business in Boston and New York, and during the summertime, has got to be crazy." "Yeah, I'll buy that," Roger said. On the TV screen, Bob Stanley popped a good curve over the outside corner to start the game. "It is Rava Shitta." "That's a pretty good sandwich, Roger," Vic said, smiling winningly at his partner. Roger grabbed up the plate and held it to his chest. "Call down for your own, you damn mooch." "What's the number?"
681, I think. It's on the dial there."
"Don't you want some beer with that?" Vic asked, going to the phone again. Roger shook his head.
"I had too much at lunch. My head's bad, my stomach's bad, and by tomorrow morning I'll probably have the Hershey squirts. I'm rapidly discovering the truth, good buddy. I'm no kid anymore."
Vic called down for a hot pastrami on rye and two bottles of Tuborg. When he hung up and looked back at Roger, Roger was sitting with his eyes fixed on the TV. His sandwich plate was balanced on his considerable belly, and he was crying. At first, Vic thought he hadn't seen right. It was some sort of optical illusion. But no, those were tears. The color TV reflected off them in prisms of light. For a moment, Vic stood there, unable to decide if he should go over to Roger or go over to the other side of the room and pick up the newspaper, pretending he hadn't seen. Then Roger looked over at him, his face working and utterly naked, as defenseless and as vulnerable as Tad's face when he fell off the swing and scraped his knees or took a tumble on the sidewalk.
"What am I going to do, Vic?" he asked hoarsely.
"Rog, what are you talking—"
"You know what I'm talking about," he said.
The crowd at Fenway cheered as Boston turned a double play to end the top of the first.
Take it easy, Roger. This is going to fall through, and we both know it, Roger said. It smells as bad as a carton of eggs that's been sitting all week in the sun. This is some nice little game we're playing. We got Rob Martin on our side. We got that refugee from the Home for Old Actors on our side. Undoubtedly, we'll have Summer's Marketing and Research on our side, since they bill us. How wonderful. We've got everybody on our side but the people who matter. Nothing's decided, Raj. Not yet.
Althea doesn't really understand how much is at stake, Roger said.
My fault. Okay. So I'm a chicken. Cluck, cluck. But she loves it in Bridgeton, Vic. She loves it there. And the girls, they've got their school friends, the lake in the summer. And they don't know what the fuck's coming down at all.
Yeah, it's scary. I'm not trying to talk you out of that, Raj.
Does Donna know how bad it is?
I think she just thought it was an awfully good joke on us at first. But she's getting the drift of it now.
But she never took to Maine the way the rest of us did.
Not at first, maybe. I think she'd raise her hands in horror at the idea of taking Tad back to New York now.
What am I gonna do?
Roger asked again.
I'm no kid anymore. You're 32, but Vic, I'm going to be 41 next month. What am I supposed to do? Start taking my resume around? Is J. Walter Thompson going to welcome me in with open arms? Hi, Raj, baby, I've been holding your old spot for you. You start at 35-5. Is that what he's going to say?
Vic only shook his head, but a part of him was a little irritated with Roger.
I used to be just mad. Well, I'm still mad. But now I'm more scared than anything else. I lie in bed at night and try to imagine how it's going to be after what it's going to be. I can't imagine it. You look at me and you say to yourself, Roger's dramatizing.
I never thought any such thing, Vic said, hoping he didn't sound guilty.
I won't say you're lying, Roger said. But I've been working with you long enough to have a pretty good idea of how you think. Better than you might know. Anyway, I wouldn't blame you for the thought. But there's a big difference between 32 and 41, Vic. They kick a lot of the guts out of you in between 32 and 41.
Look, I still think we've got a fighting chance with this proposal.
What I'd like to do is bring about 2 dozen boxes of red raspberry zingers along with us to Cleveland, Roger said, and then get them to bend over after they tie the can to our tails. I'd have a place for all that cereal, you know it?
Vic clapped Roger on the shoulder.
Yeah, I get you. What are you going to do if they pull the account? Roger asked.
Vic had thought about that. He had been around it from every possible angle. It would have been fair to say that he had gotten to the problem quite a while before Roger had been able to make himself approach it.
If they pull out, I'm going to work harder than I ever have in my life, Vic said. 30 hours a day if I have to. If I have to rope in 60 small New England accounts to make up for what Sharp billed, then I'll do it. We'll kill ourselves for nothing.
Maybe, Vic said. But we'll go down with all guns firing.
Right? I figure, Roger said unsteadily, that if Althea goes to work, we can hold on to the house for about a year. That ought to be just about enough time to sell it, the way interest rates are.
Suddenly Vic felt it trembling right behind his lips, the whole shitty black mess that Donna had managed to get herself into, because of her need to keep pretending that she was still 19 going on 20. He felt a certain dull anger at Roger, who had been happily and unquestioningly married for 15 years, Roger who had pretty, unassuming Althea to warm his bed. If Althea Breakstone had so much as contemplated infidelity, Vic would have been surprised. Roger, who had absolutely no idea of how many things could go wrong at once.
"Listen," he said. "Thursday, I got a note in the late mail."
There was a sharp rap at the door.
"That'll be room service," Roger said.
He picked up his shirt and wiped his face with it. And with the tears gone, it was suddenly unthinkable to Vic that he should tell Roger. Maybe because Roger was right after all. And the big difference was the 9 years lying between 32 and 41. Vic went to the door and got his beers and his sandwich. He didn't finish what he had been about to say when the room service waiter knocked, and Roger didn't ask him. He was back in the ball game and his own problems. Vic sat down to eat his sandwich, not entirely surprised to find that most of his appetite was gone. His eyes fell on the telephone, and, still munching, he tried home again. He let it ring a dozen times before hanging up. He was frowning slightly. It was 8:05, 5 minutes past Tad's usual bedtime. Perhaps Donna had met someone, or maybe they had gotten feeling dragged down by the empty house and gone visiting. After all, there was no law that said the tatter had to be in bed on the stroke of 8, especially when it stayed light so late and it was so damned hot. Sure, that was likely. They had maybe gone down to the common to goof around until it got cool enough to make sleep possible. Right. Or maybe she's with Kemp. That was crazy. She had said it was over, and he believed it. He really did believe it. Donna didn't lie. And she doesn't play around either, right, champ? He tried to dismiss it, but it was no good. The rat was loose, and it was going to be busy gnawing at him for some time now. What would she have done with Tad if she had suddenly taken it into her head to go off with Kemp? Were the three of them maybe in some motel right now? Some motel between Castle Rock and Baltimore? Don't be a chump, Trenton. They might... The band concert. That was it, of course. There was a concert at the Common Bandstand every Tuesday night. Some Tuesdays the high school band played, sometimes a chamber music group, sometimes a local ragtime group that called themselves the Ragged Edge. That's where they were, of course. Enjoying the cool and listening to the Ragged Edge belt their way through John Hurt's Candyman or maybe Beulah Land. Unless she's with Kemp. He drained his beer and started on another. Donna just stood outside the car for 30 seconds, moving her feet slightly on the gravel to get the pins and needles out of her legs. She watched the front of the garage, still feeling that if Cujo came, he would come from that way, maybe out of the mouth of the barn, maybe from around one of the sides, or perhaps from behind the farm truck, which looked rather canine itself by starlight, a big dusty black mongrel that was fast asleep. She stood there, not quite ready to commit herself to it yet. The night breathed at her, small fragrances that reminded her of how it had been to be small, and to smell these fragrances in all their intensity almost as a matter of routine. Clover and hay from the house at the bottom of the hill, the sweet smell of honeysuckle. And she heard something. Music. It was very faint, almost not there. But her ears, almost eerily attuned to the night now, picked it up. Someone's radio, she thought at first, and then realized with a dawning wonder that it was the band concert on the common. That was Dixieland jazz she was hearing. She could even identify the tune. It was Shuffle Off to Buffalo. 7 miles, she thought. I never would have believed it. How still the night must be. How calm. She felt very alive. Her heart was a small, powerful machine flexing in her chest. Her blood was up. Her eyes seemed to move effortlessly and perfectly in their bed of moisture. Her kidneys were heavy, but not unpleasantly so. This was it. This was for keeps. The thought that it was her life she was putting on the line, her very own real life, had a heavy, silent fascination, like a great weight which has reached the outermost degree of its angle of repose. She swung the car door shut. Clunk. She waited, scenting the air like an animal. There was nothing. The maw of Joe Camber's barn garage was dark and silent. The chrome of the Pinto's front bumper twinkled dimly. Faintly, the Dixieland music played on, fast and brassy and cheerful. She bent down, expecting her knees to pop, but they didn't. She picked up a handful of the loose gravel. One by one, she began to toss the stones over the Pinto's hood at the place she couldn't see. The first small stone landed in front of Cujo's nose, clicked off more stones, and then lay still. Cujo twitched a little. His tongue hung out. He seemed to be grinning. The second stone struck beyond him. The third struck his shoulder. He didn't move. The woman was still trying to draw him out. Donna stood by the car, frowning. She had heard the first stone click off the gravel, also the second. But the third, it was as if it had never come down. There had been no minor click. What did that mean? Suddenly, she didn't want to run for the porch door until she could see that there was nothing lurking in front of the car. Then, yes, okay, but just to make sure. She took one step. Two, three. Cujo got ready. His eyes glowed in the darkness. Four steps from the door of the car. Her heart was a drum in her chest. Now Cujo could see the woman's hips and thighs. In a moment, she would see him. Good. He wanted her to see him. Five steps from the door. Donna turned her head. Her neck creaked like the spring on an old screen door. She felt a premonition, a sense of low sureness. She turned her head, looking for Cujo. Cujo was there. He had been there all the time, crouched low, hiding from her, waiting for her, laying back in the tall bushes. Their eyes locked for a moment, Donna's wide blue ones, Cujo's muddy red ones. For a moment, she was looking out of his eyes, seeing herself, seeing the woman. Was he seeing himself through hers? Then he sprang at her. There was no paralysis this time. She threw herself backward, fumbling behind her for the door handle. He was snarling and grinning, and the drool ran out between his teeth in thick strings. He landed where she had been and skidded stiff-legged in the gravel, giving her a precious extra second. Her thumb found the door button below the handle and depressed it. She pulled. The door was stuck. The door wouldn't open. Cujo leaped at her. It was as if someone had slung a medicine ball right into the soft, vulnerable flesh of her breasts. She could feel them push out toward her ribs. It hurt. And then she had the dog by the throat, her fingers sinking into its heavy, rough fur, trying to hold it away from her. She could hear the quickening sob of her respiration. Starlight ran across Cujo's mad eyes in dull semicircles. His teeth were snapping only inches from her face, and she could smell a dead world on his breath, terminal sickness, senseless murder. She thought crazily of the drain backing up just before her mother's party, spurting green goo all over the ceiling. Somehow, using all her strength, she was able to fling him away when his back feet left the ground in another lunge at her throat. She beat helplessly behind her for the door button. She found it, but before she could even push it in, Cujo came again. She kicked out at him, and the sole of her sandal struck his muzzle, already badly lacerated in his earlier kamikaze charges at the door. The dog sprawled back on his haunches, howling out his pain and his fury. She found the button set in the door handle again, knowing perfectly well that it was her last chance, Tad's last chance. She pushed it in and pulled with all her might as the dog came again, some creature from hell that would come and come and come until she was dead, or it was. It was the wrong angle for her arm. Her muscles were working at cross purposes, and she felt an agonizing flare of pain in her back above her right shoulder blade as something sprained. But the door opened. She had just time to fall back into the bucket seat, and then the dog was on her again. Tad woke up. He saw his mother being driven back toward the Pinto's center console. There was something in his mother's lap, some terrible hairy thing with red eyes, and he knew what it was. Oh, yes, it was the thing from his closet, the thing that had promised to come a little closer and a little closer until it finally arrived right by your bed, Tad. And yes, here it was, all right, here it was. The monster words had failed. The monster was here now, and it was murdering his mommy. He began to scream, his hands clapped over his eyes. Its snapping jaws were inches from the bare flesh of her midriff. She held it off as best she could, only faintly aware of her son's screams behind her. Cujo's eyes were locked on her. Incredibly, his tail was wagging. His back legs worked at the gravel, trying to get a footing solid enough to allow him to jump right in, but the gravel kept splurting out from under his driving rear paws. He lunged forward, her hands slipped, and suddenly he was biting her bare stomach just below the white cotton cups of her bra, digging for her entrails. Donna uttered a low, feral cry of pain and shoved with both hands as hard as she could. Now she was sitting up again, blood trickling down to the waistband of her pants. She held Cujo with her left hand. Her right hand groped for the Pinto's door handle and found it. She began to slam the door against the dog. Each time she swept it forward into Cujo's ribs, there was a heavy whopping sound, like a heavy rug beater striking a carpet hung over a clothesline. Each time the door hit him, Cujo would grunt, snorting his warm, foggy breath over her. He drew back a little to spring. She timed it and brought the door toward her again, using all of her failing strength. This time the door closed on his neck and head, and she heard a crunching sound. Cujo howled his pain, and she thought, he must draw back now. He must. But Cujo drove forward instead, and his jaws closed on her lower thigh just above her knee, and with one quick ripping motion he pulled a chunk out of her. Donna shrieked. She slammed the door on Cujo's head again and again, her screams melting into Tad's, melting into a gray shock world as Cujo worked on her leg, turning it into something else, something that was red and muddy and churned up. The dog's head was plastered with thick, sticky blood, as black as insect blood in the chancy starlight. Little by little, he was forcing his way in again. Her strength was on the ebb now. She pulled the door to one final time, her head thrown back, her mouth drawn open in a quivering circle, her face a livid moving blur in the darkness. It really was the last time. There was just no more left. But suddenly, Cujo had had enough. He drew back, whining, staggering away, and suddenly fell over on the gravel, trembling, legs scratching weakly at nothing. He began to dig at his wounded head with his right forepaw. Donna slammed the door shut and lay back, sobbing weakly.
Mommy, Mommy, Mommy.
Dad, okay,
Mommy.
Okay. Hands, his on hers, fluttering and bird-like, hers on Tad's face, touching, trying to assure, then falling back.
Mommy, home, please. Daddy and home. Daddy and home.
Sure, Tad. We will. We will. Honest to God, I'll get you there. We will. No sense in the words. It was all right. She could feel herself fading back, fading into that gray shock world, those mists in herself which she had never suspected until now. Tad's words took on a deep chaining sound, words in an echo chamber. But it was all right. It was... No. It wasn't all right. Because the dog had bitten her, and the dog was rabid. Holly told her sister not to be foolish, to just dial her call direct. But Charity insisted on calling the operator and having it billed to her home number. Taking handouts, even a little thing like an after-six long-distance call, wasn't her way. The operator got her directory assistance for Maine, and Charity asked for Alva Thornton's number in Castle Rock. A few moments later, Alva's phone was ringing. Hello, Thornton's Egg Farms. Hi, Bessie? Yeah, tis. This is Charity Camber. I'm calling from Connecticut. Is Alva right around handy? Brett sat on the sofa, pretending to read a book. Gee, Charity, he ain't. He got his bowling league tonight. They're all over to the Pondicherry Lanes in Bridgeton. Something wrong? Charity had carefully and consciously decided what she was going to say. The situation was a bit delicate. Like almost every other married woman in Castle Rock, and that was not to necessarily let out the single ones, Bessie loved to talk. And if she found out that Joe Camber had gone shooting off somewhere without his wife's knowledge as soon as Charity and Brett had left to visit her sister in Connecticut, why, that would be something to talk about on the party line, wouldn't it? No, except that Brett and I got a little worried about the dog. Your Saint Bernard. Aya Cujo. Brett and I are down here visiting my sister while Joe's in Portsmouth on business. This was a barefaced lie, but a safe one. Joe did occasionally go to Portsmouth to buy parts, there was no sales tax, and to the car auctions. I just wanted to make sure he got someone to feed the dog. You know how men are. Well, Joe was over here yesterday, or the day before, I think, Bessie said doubtfully. Actually, it had been the previous Thursday. Bessie Thornton was not a terribly bright woman. Her great-aunt, the late Evie Chalmers, had been fond of screaming to anyone who would listen that Bessie wouldn't never pass none of those IQ tests, but she's good-hearted. Her life on Alva's chicken farm was a hard one, and she lived most fully during her stories, As the World Turns, The Doctors, and All My Children. She had tried The Young and the Restless, but considered it too racy by half. She tended to be fuzzy on those parts of the real world that did not bear on feeding and watering the chickens, adjusting their piped-in music, candling and sorting eggs, washing floors and clothes, doing dishes, selling eggs, tending the garden. And in the winter, of course, she could have told a questioner the exact date of the next meeting of the Castle Rock Snow Devils, the snowmobile club she and Alva belonged to. Joe had come over on that day with a tractor tire he had repaired for Alva. Joe had done the job free of charge since the Cambers got all their eggs from the Thorntons at half price. Alva also harrowed Joe's small patch of garden each April, and so Joe was glad to patch the tire. It was the way country people got along. Charity knew perfectly well that Joe had gone over to the Thorntons with the repaired tire the previous Thursday.
She also knew that Bessie was apt to get her days mixed up, all of which left her in a pretty dilemma. She could ask Bessie if Joe had had a tractor tire with him when he came up yesterday or the day before, and if Bessie said, "Why, yes, now that you mention it, he did," that would mean that Joe hadn't been up to see Alva since last Thursday, which would mean that Joe hadn't asked Alva to feed Cujo, which would also mean that Alva wouldn't have any information about Cujo's health and well-being. Or she could just leave well enough alone and ease Brett's mind. They could enjoy the rest of their visit without thoughts of home intruding constantly. And, well, she was a little jealous of Cujo right about now, tell the truth and shame the devil. Cujo was distracting Brett's attention from what could be the most important trip he ever took. She wanted the boy to see a whole new life, a whole new set of possibilities, so that when the time came, a few years from now, for him to decide which doors he wanted to step through and which ones he would allow to swing closed, he could make those decisions with a bit of perspective. Perhaps she had been wrong to believe she could steer him, but let him at least have enough experience to make up his mind for himself. Was it fair to let his worries about the damn dog stand in the way of that?
Charity, you there? I said I thought...
Aya, I heard you, Bessie. He probably did ask Alva to feed him then.
Well, I'll ask him when he gets home, Charity, and I'll let you know, too.
You do that. Thanks ever so much, Bessie.
Don't even mention it.
Fine. Goodbye.
And Charity hung up, realizing that Bessie had forgotten to ask for Jim and Holly's phone number, which was fine. She turned toward Brett, composing her face. She would say nothing that was a lie. She would not lie to her son.
Bessie said your dad was over to see Alva Sunday night, Charity said. Must have asked him to take care of Cujo then.
Oh. Brett was looking at her in a speculative way that made her a little uneasy.
But you didn't talk to Alva himself.
No, he was out bowling. But Bessie said she'd let us know if
she doesn't have our number down here.
Was Brett's tone now faintly accusatory, or was it her own conscience talking?
Well, I'll call her back in the morning, then, Charity said, hoping to close the conversation and applying some salve to her conscience at the same time.
Daddy took a tractor tire over last week, Brett said thoughtfully. Maybe Mrs. Thornton got mixed up on which day Daddy was there.
I think Bessie Thornton can keep her days straighter in her head than that, Charity said, not thinking so at all. Besides, she didn't mention anything to me about a tractor tire.
Yeah, but you didn't ask her.
Go ahead and call her back, then, Charity flashed at him.
A sudden helpless fury swept her, the same ugly feeling that had come when Brett had offered his wickedly exact observation about Holly and her deck of credit cards. When he had done that, his father's intonation, even his father's pattern of speech, had crept into his voice, and it had seemed to her, then and now, that the only thing this trip was doing was to show her once and for all who Brett really belonged to, lock, stock, and barrel.
Mom?
No. Go ahead. Call her back. The number's right here on the scratch pad.
Just tell the operator to charge it to our phone so it won't go on Holly's bill.
Ask Bessie all your questions. I only did the best I could.
There, she thought with sad and bitter amusement. Just 5 minutes ago, I wasn't going to lie to him. That afternoon, her anger had sparked anger in him. Tonight, he only said quietly,
"Nah. That's okay.
If you want, we'll call somebody else and have them go up and check," Charity said. She was already sorry for her outburst.
Who would we call? Brett asked. Well, what about one of the Milliken brothers?
Brett only looked at her.
Maybe that's not such a good idea, Charity agreed.
Late last winter, Joe Camber and John Milliken had had a bitter argument over the charge on some repair work Joe had done on the Milliken brothers' old Chevy Bel Air. Since then, the Cambers and the Millikens hadn't been talking much. The last time Charity had gone to play Beano down at the Grange, she had tried to pass a friendly word with Kim Milliken, Freddie's daughter, but Kim wouldn't say a word to her, just walked away with her head up as if she hadn't been acting the slut with half the boys in Castle Rock High School. It occurred to her now how really isolated they were up at the end of Town Road Number 3. It made her feel lonely and a little chilled. She could think of no one she could reasonably ask to go up to the place with a flashlight and hunt up Cujo and make sure he was okay.
Never mind, Brett said listlessly. Probably stupid anyway. He probably just ate some burdocks or something.
Listen, Charity said, putting an arm around him. One thing you aren't is stupid, Brett.
I'll call Alva himself in the morning and ask him to go up. I'll do it as soon as we get up. Okay?
Would you, Mom?
Yes.
That'd be great. I'm sorry to bug you about it, but I can't seem to get it off my mind.
Jim popped his head in. I got out the Scrabble board. Anyone want to play?
I will,
Brett said, getting up.
If you show me how.
What about you, Charity?
Charity smiled.
Not just now, I guess. I'll be in for some of the popcorn.
Brett went out with his uncle. She sat on the sofa and looked at the telephone and thought of Brett nightwalking, feeding a phantom dog food in her sister's modern kitchen. Cujo's not hungry no more. Not no more. Her arms suddenly tightened and she shivered. We're going to take care of this business tomorrow morning, she promised herself, one way or the other. Either that or go back and take care of it ourselves. That's a promise, Brett.
Vic tried home again at 10 o'clock. There was no answer. He tried again at 11 o'clock, and there was still no answer, although he let the phone ring 24 times. At 10, he was beginning to be scared. At 11, he was good and scared. Of what, he was not precisely sure. Roger was sleeping. Vic dialed the number in the dark, listened to it ring in the dark, hung up in the dark. He felt alone, childlike, lost. He didn't know what to do or what to think. Over and over, his mind played a simple litany. She's gone off with Kemp, gone off with Kemp, gone off with Kemp. All reason and logic was against it. He played over everything he and Donna had said to each other. He played it over again and again, listening to the words and to the nuances of tone in his mind. She and Kemp had had a falling out. She had told him to go peddle his papers somewhere else. And that had prompted Kemp's vengeful little billet doux. It did not seem the rosy scenery into which two mad lovers might decide to elope. A falling out doesn't preclude a later rapprochement, his mind retorted with a kind of grave and implacable calm.
But what about Tad? She wouldn't have taken Tad with her, would she?
From her description, Kemp sounded like some sort of wild man. And although Donna hadn't said so, Vic had gotten the feeling that something damned violent had almost happened on the day she told him to fuck off. People in love do strange things.
That strange and jealous part of his mind, he hadn't even been aware of that part in him until that afternoon in Deering Oaks, had an answer for everything. And in the dark, it didn't seem to matter that most of the answers were irrational. He was doing a slow dance back and forth between two sharpened points, Kemp on one,
Do you have any questions? A vision of the telephone ringing on in their empty Castle Rock house on the other. She could have had an accident. She and Tad could be in the hospital. Someone could have broken in. They could be lying murdered in their bedrooms. Of course, if she'd had an accident, someone official would have been in touch. The office, as well as Donna, knew in which Boston hotel he and Roger were staying. But in the dark, that thought, which should have been a comfort since no one had been in touch, only inclined his thoughts more toward murder. Robbery and murder, his mind whispered as he lay awake in the dark. Then it danced slowly across to the other sharpened point and took up its original litany, "Gone off with Kemp." In between these points, his mind saw a more reasonable explanation, one that made him feel helplessly angry. Perhaps she and Tad had decided to spend the night with someone and had simply forgotten to call and tell him. Now it was too late to start calling around and asking people without alarming them. He supposed he could call the sheriff's office and ask them to send someone up and check, but wouldn't that be overreacting? No, his mind said. Yes, his mind said, definitely. She and Tad are both dead with knives stuck in their throats, his mind said. You read about it in the papers all the time. It even happened in Castle Rock just before we came to town. That crazy cop, that Frank Dodd. Gone off with Kemp, his mind said. At midnight, he tried again, and this time the constant ringing of the phone with no one to pick it up froze him into a deadly certainty of trouble. Kemp, robbers, murderers, something. Trouble. Trouble at home. He dropped the phone back into its cradle and turned on the bed lamp. Roger, he said, wake up.
Huh? Huzz.
Roger had his arm over his eyes, trying to block out the light. He was in his pajamas with the little yellow college pennants.
Roger! Roger!
Roger opened his eyes, blinked, looked at the travelette clock.
Hey, Vic, it's the middle of the night.
Roger. He swallowed and something clicked in his throat. Roger. It's midnight, and Tad and Donna still aren't home. I'm scared. Roger sat up and brought the clock close to his face to verify what Vic had said. It was now 4 past the hour.
Well, they probably got freaked out staying there by themselves, Vic. Sometimes Althea takes the girls and goes over to Sally Petrie's when I'm gone. She gets nervous when the wind blows off the lake at night, she says. She would have called.
With the light on, with Roger sitting up and talking to him, the idea that Donna might have just run off with Steve Kemp seemed absurd. He couldn't believe he had ever even indulged it. Forget logic. She had told him it was over, and he had believed her. He believed her now.
Called?
Roger said. He was still having trouble tracking things.
She knows I call home almost every night when I'm away. She would have called the hotel and left a message if she was going to be gone overnight, wouldn't Althea?
Roger nodded.
Yeah, she would.
She'd call and leave a message so you wouldn't worry, like I'm worrying now.
Yeah. But she might have just forgotten, Vic.
Still, Roger's brown eyes were troubled.
Sure, Vic said. On the other hand, maybe something's happened. She carries ID, doesn't she? If she and Tad were in an accident, God forbid, the cops would try home first and then the office. The answering service would...
I wasn't thinking about an accident, Vic said. I was thinking about... His voice began to tremble.
I was thinking about her and
Tatter being there alone and... Shit, I don't know. I just got scared, that's all.
Call the sheriff's office, Roger said promptly.
Yeah, but
nothing. You aren't going to scare Donna, that's for sure. She's not there. But what the hell? Set your mind at rest. It doesn't have to be sirens and flashing lights. Just ask if they can send a cop by to check and make sure that everything looks normal. There must be 1,000 places she could be. Hell, maybe she just tied into a really good Tupperware party.
Donna hates Tupperware parties.
So maybe the girl's got playing penny ante poker and lost track of the time, and Tad's asleep in someone's spare room.
Vic remembered her telling him how she had steered clear of any deep involvement with the girls. I don't want to be one of those faces you see at the bake sales, she had said. But he didn't want to tell Roger that. It was too close to the subject of Kemp.
Yeah, maybe something like that, Vic said. Have you got an extra key to the place tucked away somewhere? There's one on a hook under the eave on the front porch. Tell the cops. Someone can go in and have a good look around. Unless you've got pot or coke or something you'd just assume they didn't stumble over.
Nothing like that.
Then do it, Roger said earnestly. She'll probably call here while they're out checking and you'll feel like a fool, but sometimes it's good to feel like a fool. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Vic said, grinning a little. Yeah, I do.
He picked the telephone up again, hesitated, then tried home again first. No answer. Some of the comfort he had gotten from Roger evaporated. He got directory assistance from Maine and jotted down the number of the Castle County Sheriff's Department. It was now nearly 12:15 on Wednesday morning. Donna Trenton was sitting with her hands resting lightly on the steering wheel of the Pinto. Tad had finally fallen asleep again, but his sleep was not restful. He twisted, turned, sometimes moaned. She was afraid he was reliving in his dreams what had happened earlier. She felt his forehead. He muttered something and pulled away from her touch. His eyelids fluttered and then slipped closed again. He felt feverish, almost surely a result of the constant tension and fear. She felt feverish herself. And she was in severe pain. Her belly hurt, but those wounds were superficial, little more than scratches. She had been lucky there. Cujo had damaged her left leg more. The wounds there, the bites, her mind insisted, as if relishing the horror of it, were deep and ugly. They had bled a lot before clotting, and she hadn't tried to apply a bandage right away, although there was a first aid kit in the Pinto's glove box. Vaguely, she supposed she had hoped that the flowing blood would wash the wound clean. Did that really happen, or was it just an old wives' tale? She didn't know. There was so much she didn't know. So goddamn much. By the time the lacerated punctures had finally clotted, her thigh and the driver's bucket seat were both tacky with her blood. She needed 3 gauze pads from the first aid kit to cover the wound. They were the last 3 in the kit. Have to replace those, she thought. And that brought on a short hysterical fit of the giggles. In the faint light, the flesh just above her knee had looked like dark, plowed earth. There was a steady, throbbing ache there that had not changed since the dog bit her. She had dry-swallowed a couple of aspirin from the kit, but they didn't make a dent in the pain. Her head ached badly, too, as if a bundle of wires were slowly being twisted tighter and tighter inside each temple. Flexing the leg brought the quality of the pain up from the throbbing ache to a sharp, glassy beat. She had no idea if she could even walk on the leg now, let alone run for the porch door. And did it really matter? The dog was sitting on the gravel between her car door and the door which gave on the porch, its hideously mangled head drooping, but with its eyes fixed unfailingly on the car.
on her.
Somehow she didn't think Cujo was going to move again, at least not tonight. Tomorrow the sun might drive him into the barn, if it was as hot as it had been yesterday.
"It wants me," she whispered through her blistered lips.
It was true. For reasons decreed by fate, or for its own unknowable ones, the dog wanted her. When it had fallen on the gravel, she had been sure it was dying. No living thing could have taken the pounding she had given it with the door. Even its thick fur hadn't been able to cushion the blows. One of the St. Bernard's ears appeared to be dangling by no more than a string of flesh. But it had regained its feet, little by little. She hadn't been able to believe her eyes. Hadn't wanted to believe her eyes.
"No!"
she had shrieked, totally out of control.
"No! Lie down! You're supposed to be dead! Lie down! Lie down and die, you shit dog!"
"Mommy, don't,"
Tad had murmured, holding his head.
"It hurts. It hurts me."
Since then, nothing in the situation had changed. Time had resumed its former slow crawl. She had put her watch to her ear several times to make sure it was still ticking, because the hands never seemed to change position. 12:20.
"What do we know about rabies, class?"
"Precious little. Some hazy fragments that had probably come from Sunday supplement articles, a pamphlet leafed through idly back in New York when she had taken the family cat Dinah for her distemper shot at the vets. Excuse me, distemper and rabies shots. Rabies, a disease of the central nervous system, the good old CNS, causes slow destruction of same." But how? She was blank on that, and probably the doctors were, too. Otherwise, the disease wouldn't be considered so damn dangerous. "Of course," she thought hopefully, "I don't even know for sure that the dog is rabid. The only rabid dog I've ever seen was the one Gregory Peck shot with a rifle in To Kill a Mockingbird. Except, of course, that dog wasn't really rabid. It was just pretend. It was probably some mangy mutt they'd gotten from the local pound, and they put Gillette Foamy all over him." She pulled her mind back to the point. Better to make what Vic called a worst-case analysis, at least for now. Besides, in her heart she was sure the dog was rabid. What else would make it behave as it had? The dog was as mad as a hatter. And it had bitten her, badly. What did that mean? People could get rabies, she knew, and it was a horrible way to die, maybe the worst. There was a vaccine for it, and a series of injections was the prescribed method of treatment. The injections were quite painful, although probably not as painful as going the way the dog out there was going, but she seemed to remember reading that there were only two instances where people had lived through an advanced case of rabies, a case, that is, that had not been diagnosed until the carriers had begun exhibiting symptoms. One of the survivors was a boy who had recovered entirely. The other had been an animal researcher who had suffered permanent brain damage. The good old CNS had just fallen apart. The longer the disease went untreated, the less chance there was. She rubbed her forehead, and her hands skidded across a film of cold sweat. How long was too long? Hours? Days? Weeks? A month, maybe? She didn't know. Suddenly, the car seemed to be shrinking. It was the size of a Honda, then the size of one of those strange little three-wheelers they used to give disabled people in England, then the size of an enclosed motorcycle sidecar, finally the size of a coffin, a double coffin for her and Tad. They had to get out! Get out! Get
out!
Her hand was fumbling for the door handle before she got hold of herself again. Her heart was racing, accelerating the thudding in her head.
Please, she thought. It's bad enough without claustrophobia, so please, please, please.
Her thirst was back again, raging. She looked out, and Cujo stared implacably back at her, his body seemingly split in two by the silver crack running through the window.
Help us, someone, she thought. Please, please help us.
Roscoe Fisher was parked back in the shadows of Jerry's Citgo when the call came in. He was ostensibly watching for speeders, but in actual fact, he was cooping. At 12:30 on a Wednesday morning, Route 117 was totally dead. He had a little alarm clock inside his skull, and he trusted it to wake him up around 1 when the Norway drive-in let out. Then there might be some action.
Unit 3, come in. Unit 3, over.
Roscoe snapped awake, spilling cold coffee in a styrofoam cup down into his crotch.
Oh, shit, fire, Roscoe said dolefully. Now that's nice, isn't it? Key riced. Unit 3, you copy? Over.
He grabbed the mic and pushed the button on the side.
I copy, base.
He would have liked to have added that he hoped it was good because he was sitting with his balls in a puddle of cold coffee, but you never knew who was monitoring police calls on his or her trusty Bearcat scanner, even at 12:30 in the morning.
"Want you to take a run up to 83 Latch Street," Billy said. "Residence of Mr. and Mrs. Victor Trenton. Check the place out. Over." "What am I checking for, base? Over." "Trenton's in Boston, and no one's answering his calls. He thinks someone should be home. Over." "Well, that's wonderful, isn't it?" Roscoe Fisher thought sourly. "For this, I got a $4 cleaning bill. And if I do have to stop a speeder, the guy's going to think I got so excited at the prospect of a collar that I pissed myself." 10-4 and time out," Roscoe said, starting his cruiser. "Over." "I make it 12:34 a.m., Billy said. "There's a key hanging on a nail under the front porch eave, Unit 3. Mr. Trenton would like you to go right on inside and look around if the premises appear deserted. Over." "Roger, base. Over and out." "Out." Roscoe popped on his headlights and cruised down Castle Rock's deserted main street, past the common and the bandstand with its conical green roof. He went up the hill and turned right on Larch Street near the top. The Trentons was the second house from the corner, and he saw that in the daytime they would have a nice view of the town below. He pulled the Sheriff's Department Fury 3 up to the curb and got out, closing the door quietly. The street was dark, fast asleep. He paused for a moment, pulling the wet cloth of his uniform trousers away from his crotch, grimacing as he did it, and then went up the driveway. The driveway was empty, and so was the small one-car garage at the end of it. He saw a big wheels trike parked inside. It was just like the one his own son had. He closed the garage door and went around to the front porch. He saw that this week's copy of the call was leaning against the porch door. Roscoe picked it up and tried the door. It was unlocked. He went onto the porch, feeling like an intruder. He tossed the paper on the porch glider and pushed the bell beside the inner door. Chimes went off in the house, but no one came. He rang twice more over a space of about 3 minutes, allowing for the time it would take the lady to wake up, put on a robe, and come downstairs, if the lady was there. When there was still no answer, he tried the door. It was locked. "Husband's away, and she's probably staying over with friends," he thought.
But the fact that she hadn't notified her husband also struck Roscoe Fisher as mildly strange. He felt under the peaked eave, and his fingers knocked off the key Vic had hung up there not long after the Trentons had moved in. He took it down and unlocked the front door. If he had tried the kitchen door, as Steve Kemp had that afternoon, he could have walked right in. Like most people in Castle Rock, Donna was slipshod about buttoning up when she went out. Roscoe went in. He had his flashlight, but he preferred not to use it. That would have made him feel even more like an unlawful intruder, a burglar with a large coffee stain on his crotch. He felt for a switch plate and eventually found one with two switches. The top one turned on the porch light, and he turned that one off quickly. The bottom one turned on the living room light. He looked around for a long moment, doubting what he was seeing. At first he thought it must be some trick of his eyes, that they had not adjusted to the light or something. But nothing changed, and his heart began to pump quickly. "Mustn't touch anything," he thought. "Can't balls this up." He had forgotten about the wet coffee splotch on his pants, and he had forgotten about feeling like an intruder. He was scared and excited. Something had happened here, all right. The living room had been turned topsy-turvy. There was shattered glass from a knick-knack shelf all over the floor. The furniture had been overturned. The books had been scattered every which way. A big mirror over the fireplace was also broken. 7 years bad luck for somebody, Roscoe thought, and found himself thinking suddenly and for no reason about Frank Dodd, with whom he had often shared a cruiser. Frank Dodd, the friendly small-town cop, who had just happened to also be a psycho who murdered women and little children. Roscoe's arms broke out in a goose flesh suddenly. This was no place to be thinking about Frank. He went into the kitchen through the dining room, where everything had been swept off the table. He skirted that mess carefully. The kitchen was worse. He felt a fresh chill creep down his spine. Someone had gone absolutely crazy in here. The doors to the bar cabinet stood open, and someone had used the length of the kitchen like a pitch-till-you-win alley at a county fair. Pots were everywhere, and white stuff that looked like snow but had to be soap powder. Written on the message board in large and hurried block letters was this: "I left something upstairs for you, baby." Suddenly, Roscoe Fisher didn't want to go upstairs. More than anything else, he didn't want to go up there. He had helped clean up three of the messes Frank Dodd had left behind him, including the body of Mary Kate Henderson, who had been raped and murdered on the Castle Rock bandstand in the common. He never wanted to see anything like that again. And suppose the woman was up there, shot, or slashed, or strangled. Roscoe had seen plenty of mayhem on the roads, and had even got used to it after a fashion. 2 summers ago, he and Billy and Sheriff Bannerman had pulled a man out of a potato grading machine in pieces, and that had been one to tell your grandchildren about. But he had not seen a homicide since the Henderson girl, and he did not want to see one now. He didn't know whether to be relieved or disgusted by what he found on the Trentons' bedspread. He went back to his car and called in. When the telephone rang, Vic and Roger were both up, sitting in front of the TV, not talking much, smoking their heads off. Frankenstein, the original film, was on. It was 1:20. Vic grabbed the phone before it had completed its first ring. "Hello, Donna, is this Mr. Trenton?" A man's voice. "Yes." "This is Sheriff Bannerman, Mr. Trenton. I'm afraid I have some rather upsetting information for you. I'm sorry." "Are they dead?" Vic asked. Suddenly, he felt totally unreal and two-dimensional, no more real than the face of an extra glimpsed in the background of an old movie, such as the one he and Roger had been watching. The question came out in a perfectly conversational tone of voice. From the corner of his eye, he saw Roger's shadow move as he stood up quickly. It didn't matter. Nothing else did either. In the space of the few seconds that had passed since he had answered the phone, he had had a chance to get a good look behind his life, and had seen it was all stage scenery and false fronts.
Mr. Trenton, Officer Fisher was dispatched. Dispense with the official bullshit and answer my question. Are they dead? He turned to Roger. Roger's face was gray and wondering. Behind him on the TV, a phony windmill turned against a phony sky. Raj, got a cigarette?
Roger handed him one.
Mr. Trenton, are you still there?
Yes. Are they dead?